All right, No Jumper, coolest podcast in the world. Today we have one of my favorite music rap journalists, David Drake. David, how you doing?
I'm doing great. And thank you for that.
I've been telling people, you know, like whenever people in interviews or whatever ask me about like my influences or whatever, a lot of times I end up mentioning you and Nas and John Caramonica as like my favorite writers. But the truth is, I don't actually know that.
White boy crew.
Yeah, white boy crew, exactly. But I don't actually know that much about you as a person, so I'm like pretty excited to have like a good sit down. And for anybody out there who's maybe trying to learn, you know, how they could possibly make it in this field, hopefully we could get some good information out there.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Sorry. So, where are you from? Let's go back to the beginning.
I'm from Chicago. I was born in Chicago. We moved out of state, so I lived in Vermont a couple of years when I was a kid, and then we moved back to Chicago, and I ended up going to junior high and high school in Evanston, which is a city it's right at the border of Chicago on the north side,
right,
along the beach, and that was a great place to be for.
What kind of upbringing did you have? Like, what were your parents into, and did you have a pretty standard upbringing, or?
Evanston is a pretty interesting place because it's like it's very diverse. It's sort of a Berkeley, I think. Okay. I've never been to Berkeley. I'm just like,
it's like an open-minded like community of intellectuals.
It's progressive. There are two suburbs like this in the Chicago areas, like Oak Park and Evanston are often compared to each other because they have a fair amount of money. Like Northwestern University is in Evanston.
Okay.
So there's definitely some well-off people there. Uh-huh. So you have a lot of resources, but at the same time, it's there's a lot of economic and racial diversity. And, you know, there was like a real hip-hop scene there and lots of different layers to that.
When did you discover that? Or were you listening to hip-hop before you like discovered that there were shows and everything going on?
Yeah, definitely. Okay. So I was listening mostly through the radio. So when I moved back to Chicago.
At what age?
I moved back at 10, age 10. So to answer your original question, like my family, we were like one of the handful of poor white families in Evanston. There were not a lot. It was very like polarized in that way along racial and class lines.
And were you super aware of this even as a kid that you were kind of an outlier in that sense?
I don't think I was aware that I was an outlier. I was aware that we didn't have money.
Right.
I definitely wanted Jordans, and I was not getting Jordans. And
but that must have been weird because you're operating on these like racial lines as well as class lines, so you're kind of out of the ordinary in that sense. But
And I mean, I think it made me probably like it's probably part of why I ended up in some way becoming a writer. There's some sort of like I don't want to like over intellectualize my own like why I became who I am, like as if it determined it, but.
Well, that's what we do here. We over intellectualize everything. Yeah.
I think that I did feel like maybe a bit apart from things, and that made me more. I would have to like rationalize why I experienced the world in a different way than the people that I was supposed to be socializing with. It made like I don't know. I'm having trouble explaining this the right way, but. It was a very interesting place to grow up because you got a lot of different perspectives and none of them necessarily aligned with how I felt I was.
Right.
But as a result, I sort of felt like I got to know lots of different kinds of people. It was a really good environment for that. And I got to, I began to enjoy difference or enjoy like the experience of getting to know people who have had different experiences or that was like a really key part of like what I appreciate is this aesthetically is this sort of idea of not just the surface level of the aesthetic of the, you know, oh, this person raps like this, but the story around it, the context of it, why does it sound like that? The like this like idea of there being a world that all sort of fluidly makes up this sound.
Right.
The idea of like of a scene being and a fan base affecting how music sounds and that kind of stuff, I could definitely trace back to that kind of like environment where you had like, it was a large urban high school and the jocks didn't really rule the school.
Okay.
It was like instead you would have like super smart athletes who were like set on going to Harvard.
Right.
And you would also have like, and again, you had the resources because this was this was a community with a lot of resources.
Right.
But at the same time, you had like, I think that probably the racial difference really kept, because that's like sort of a core polarizing fact,
right,
in America, right? I think that Evanston became like a microcosm of that because it was a small space.
And it was diverse early on. But would you say that race relations were good and that people kind of got along better than they did in other parts of the country because it was a little bit more accepting?
I would say yes, but like I hesitate. So like I remember when like reading about Dave Chappelle's background,
right,
and he would talk about how he describes his upbringing in Ohio is that reminds me of Evanston in that way. It's like a, which is to say that on the one hand, yes, because you become, you're so, you're up close with like the your social groups are not, even in Chicago itself, I feel like, except for a few, maybe the magnet schools and that kind of like the places Chance came out of, things are so segregated,
right,
that you don't, there's not a lot of interaction. Evanston, because it's small, relatively speaking,
right,
you end up with a lot more opportunities to like understand different ways,
right,
different experiences and that sort of thing. And that I don't think that necessarily makes, it definitely makes people more understanding or empathic, maybe, particularly white people. But I don't know that it necessarily solves any of the core, like,
yeah,
polarizing facts of race or in America. Like, I don't think that, I think that if places, more places were like Evanston, it would be like, it would be better for the, you know, character of the people.
Right.
But I don't think that it would actually solve race or something
racism,
like that.
Yeah. Because yeah, we always that sort of do that comparison with like New York and then LA, because in LA everybody's just in their cars and people of like, you know, high economic status don't really have to intermingle with poor people because they're just in their car on the highway, whatever. But in New York, everybody's on the fucking subway together and they're sort of around each other, and I think it like fosters a place where at least people are more like understanding of like, oh, there's Hasidic Jews in my neighborhood, there's Puerto Rican guys in my neighborhood, and everybody just kind of just maybe not talking to each other, but they're around each other. In LA, we like miss out on that a lot.
Yeah, I think New York, I've definitely noticed that going in, like moving into New York. One of the funniest things, so I lived in New York for like 3 years. And one of the funniest things when I first moved into my first, it was not my first regular apartment. Like I crashed with people for a while, but when I first moved into my apartment, it was over a nightclub. And, you know, when a lot of the Chicago rap music blew up that I wrote about, a lot of a lot of the response to it that was to the hip hop scene that was negative was about like the hipster reactions to this violent street rap.
Right.
And in Chicago, I'm like, the hipsters that I see are, it's not as quite as cosmopolitan, or it wasn't at the time, I have a place, as New York is.
Right.
And so I'm like, I don't hear hipsters listening to like Chief Keef and
in
Katie
Chicago.
And Katie Gabb at that time.
Yeah.
When it first blew up, like aside from like the stuff I like, my friends weren't listening to that, like,
right,
in like my Logan Square friends,
right?
But like when I moved to New York, I'm moving up above this nightclub and I'm hearing Katie Got Bands like blasting out of the speakers. I'm like, oh, like I get like New York has that, like, I think it has the way that race is a kind of, it's different than in Chicago, that the way that it manifests itself is very like, because it's less segregated and people are on top of each other, it's way more like, oh, like people are, feel more entitled to be fluent in.
But don't you think that in Chicago, like, the, I think, like, when I look at smaller cities or whatever, especially in that time period, I feel like a lot of hipsters are sort of like 1.0 type hipsters that aren't, that feel like they're above gangster rap. And then in New York at that time, when you're talking about moving there, is like, it's a little bit more advanced. Like I'm saying hipster, but I'm not really actually saying it in a derogatory way at all. But like people are like interacting with hip hop music and able to look at it from a perspective of like, oh, this is cool, even if I don't directly relate to this.
I think that there's, and so I don't want to like overstate it, because Chicago is, you know, still the third largest city in the U.S.
Right.
It does have like, you know, I know hipsters. I've known some hipsters, and a lot of them are very like aware of like culturally what's happening, mm-hmm. especially like with the internet, it kind of like breaks down right. a lot of that. But even then, yes, I think that it is a matter, like one of the things I think a lot about this, like what, when you think about artists that you're excited about or something and you're mm-hmm. like, well, this guy's cool, but his songs aren't that good. And this guy's songs are good, but he's not that cool, but he has a lot of fans. Like
right.
there's different. And I think about what cool means and like how that behaves in the real world, like how that comes together. And one of the things that I think is always understated about cool is a sort of, it's an implied intuitive understanding of things.
Right.
An idea that you get shit intuitively
right.
that other people would have to study or research or like, right?
True, yeah.
I'm intellectualizing no, the true. Shit out of this, but like, and I think that that's where like the sort of New York idea of the drill stuff as like a hipster phenomenon
right.
is this like, oh yeah, I get this.
Right.
That's why I'm cool.
Like, yeah.
Like
yeah.
without like, and I imagine that is in part how, and that was something that, like, felt kind of alien to me in Chicago at the time.
Right.
But again, Chicago is like extremely segregated. So when I see this, I'm like talking to people that are like in the hip hop scene that are following the Keef thing. And it was extremely divisive, you know, right. from the beginning. But that's like, anyway, that's what, like the people that were following that stuff in Chicago, it was not a hipster thing there until it was a hipster thing in New York.
Right.
Until the press in New York covers it, and then it comes back.
What was the first thing you ever wrote about Keef?
About Keef?
Yeah.
Just a Fader post. As okay. I was blogging for Fader at that point.
Right.
And it was about Bang.
Yeah, and this is like I guess we should go back a little bit more. Like, when did you start writing? Like, when did you figure out, like, oh, I'm going to write, and oh, I'm going to write about rap music?
So I kind of fell into it accidentally because I never was, like, one of those people who, like, watched Almost Famous.
And, all right.
Although I have the baby face.
Yeah.
I didn't
yeah.
actually... I was not like I'm going to be a music journalist, and this is like what I want to do. If anything, I wanted to DJ. Like,
right.
So I would DJ these parties in college, just like little things, not like big events or not trying to make money. It wasn't like a career thing. It was just like I really enjoyed thinking about how music made people react, that sort of connection that you get with people
yeah.
when you play a song for them and they respond to it emotionally, and that's always, I liked it.
Right.
So basically, I started reading music writing because at the time, like 2003, that was the best way to find music ahead of everybody, to find the like coolest shit that would make people respond the best.
And like rap writing on the internet in 2003 like barely existed. This is when like the internet was sort of starting to become self-aware of like, oh, like people can write about rap on here.
Yeah. And what was great about that was that you had like these random people from across the, and this still exists, it's just that there's a lot more like noise around the signal.
Yeah.
But there, you would find a random kid from Atlanta or a random guy from Baltimore, like Al Shipley's
yep.
still doing it, or you'd find a guy just all over the country. I mean, that's how like the original XXL blogs, I know, you know, Fresh, she's she did the Crunk and Disorderly blog.
Right.
They discovered her when she was like either a teenager or in her early 20s. Just because she was blogging on the internet, I think, I don't know if it was Elliot Wilson discovered her or someone, but she became an XXL blogger. She was in the South. She'd gotten out of job court. Like, there was this time where you could, like, the most ambitious people, like, that were had the sensibility that they could be on the internet all day before anybody else was.
Yeah.
Which is a very weird, like, group of people.
Yeah, yeah.
It made it very easy to find something totally outside of your worldview.
Right.
And like I was saying about like Evanston making that like a thing that attracted me.
Right.
I was like, this is so cool. I can hear that. One of my favorite writers was a guy who wrote about dance music in Australia.
Right.
And I was like, I had never thought about how you write to think about music that way. It wasn't necessarily about writing.
Yeah.
To me, it was about the way that he thought about music was totally different from any way that I had ever considered thinking about music.
Right.
And I found that like, that was what fascinated me. And it also led me to great music.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't even like a lot of music writing in the, like when I would read in magazines in the 90s, because it didn't really jive with how I understood the music I was hearing. I'm like, how does he get that out of this?
Right.
And I like, so I totally get it when people say that about music criticism in general. It's like, they're not even talking about, but I know that there's good music writing because I found it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And that was what made me want to do it, was there were people who felt like they were inside my brain, even though they were completely different from me in background, in sexual orientation, and, you know, in any, like, they were able to understand something about the music that, like, resonated in a way that made sense to me. And then, like, when I would DJ, it was like I could test these things out and be right, like, oh, yeah, this works because, you know, what he said about this makes sense.
Hey, throw a couple more names at me, people that you were influenced by, especially in the hip-hop space at that time, that, like, people that you looked at and you were like, this guy's killing it.
So especially hip-hop, I mean, everybody read Dylan King did the Government Names blog with Al Shipley.
Right.
And he was he was something else. All the Government Names archives that he wrote as DK were a very unique creation. He was this kid from Canada who was obsessed with Houston rap.
Right.
And I don't know. They're very interesting. I liked, you know, I mean, I just did a piece last year, the year before, on Frankie the Lucky Dog, who is a kid from Peckville, Pennsylvania.
Right.
I think that's right. Who was obsessed with Baton Rouge rap music.
Yeah.
And, like, has Asperger's. And it was, like, manifested itself for him in this, like, obsessive, manic cataloging and collecting of music. But it wasn't just the cataloging of it, of the, like, record keeping and that kind of thing. But he also has, like, these very emotional respect. He would do, like, live music reviews. Like, the review was done live.
Right.
He would, like, set a camera on himself and type up the review live. And, like, weird guys like this, to me, so, like, way more than, like, guys who are trying to build canons, like, these big, like, fancy ideas of how the music should be.
Right.
I was way more interested in people who did captured, like, elements of things that felt true in the cultures to me, that, like, I was like, wow, that's, like, a crazy, it was just the kind of thing that was really hard to come by. Like, they found you stuff that you didn't even know existed,
right,
or that you needed to know about. Or,
and it was just so internet, too, because it's like, oh, like the live blogging thing. I wasn't aware of that at the time or whatever, but that's the kind of thing that never, ever could have took place in the Source or XXL.
Right.
And then all of a sudden we have the internet, and here's people who are actually using the internet or writing in such ways and doing all... Like, the prevailing theme at that time, I think, was just, like, people from outside the South who are writing about the South. And that was, like... You know, like the Martorialist is a dude who I always read like crazy, and that was like his whole deal, is that he was
from the UK.
Yeah, yeah, right. And he's writing about like Southern hip hop in a way that's very, very like well done and like smart and everything. And that's just kind of, I mean, I guess some people might now look at that and be like, oh, that's kind of weird, but at the time it was like amazing and really like exciting to see so many people from all over the world who are excited about like little niche hip hop scenes.
Right, And especially, so I should have mentioned Ethan Padgett was another one. I don't know if you ever read the Gel and Weave blog.
Oh, okay. I remember that name, yeah.
I mean, he was like, I remember when he put The Wider World onto Icy by Gucci Mane. Like,
right.
That was how I first heard that. Was not through the radio. It wasn't in clubs or radio yet. He was a writer from Atlanta. And Icy was like, you know, of course, went on to be this huge hit. And
right.
Like, he did like this blog post on Lil Boosie when Boosie was getting 2,000 for a show, or I think that was it, or feature. It was like a, you know, back before Boosie had a hit,
before
Gimme That, before, I mean, that was Webby, but before any of that stuff blew up. And I think that was like such a cool, like watching how it would go from a niche scene to the mainstream was
right.
Like a big part of it. So it wasn't like, I wasn't totally obsessed with it being different. What interested me also, I guess, was like the connection between stuff that's super niche and stuff that's insanely popular.
Right.
And how the actual distance between those two things is very small.
And putting them on the same platform and judging them, you know, as if they're almost the same thing. Or like both these things deserve equal amounts of respect regardless.
Or that they can't, like they can.
They can have.
Some things deserve less respect.
Right, yeah, totally. You know, one of my favorite things that I remember you writing back in the day and that like actually solidified so many shrimp in my head is like, oh, okay, this is a blog that I really fuck with, is like just maybe a series of posts or a couple of posts about Gucci and OJ, that where you were just sort of like talking about their lyrics and the actual music in a way that I hadn't seen anybody do at the time. And like, you just had like a real inherent respect for these guys who a lot of people were sort of willing to write off as like, yeah, it's funny, it's catchy, whatever, but it's garbage. It's not real hip hop. That was a lot of people's opinions at the time. But
definitely. Yeah.
Where did that come from? And do you remember when you had a similar like realization of like, oh, this trap music is deserving of the same level of introspection as something else that's more lofty? Or
I mean, the first time I felt like that, I think, would be like when I was 10 years old and hearing like Dear Mama on the radio or something.
Right.
That Tupac record or like, and then I went, you know, you go through this period, I think, in high school when people are starting to move off into cliques.
Right.
And you start to define yourself, like, who am I and what does my identity have to do? And when you do that, I think that this is true of everyone to some degree, is you start to think in terms that are classist and racist, and just generally you're like, what do successful people do, or what?
Right.
I mean everyone thinks, I mean, obviously who they are will end up shaping where they go in that.
Right.
But like, and how much, you know, awareness of that dynamic they have. But there was definitely like, you know, this period where I start thinking in terms of, suddenly my music taste shifts to being like more respectable. I want to enjoy stuff that I think deserve, that is classy.
That makes you feel intellectual by listening to it, right?
And I mean, I think, but it's only like a partial thing. It's not like I was 100% like I only listened to classy music or something.
Right.
I mean, I started playing trumpet and I was really into jazz, and I was doing like, and I also was like fascinated just by musicality in general. So that's like a different kind of, that overlaps
right
with it. Like, obviously jazz is considered super respectable by society at this right. point, but once I start reading and digging into jazz music, I start to recognize these kinds of same judgments happen within that genre,
right,
where people are like, this is the really high art jazz, and right. this is the sort of groovy low
who's
art,
that
like,
OJ the Juice Man of jazz. The hardest question.
He's probably forgotten by now, honestly.
Thank God we're keeping OJ alive. Yeah,
a session play. I mean, you know, I love OJ.
Oh yeah,
he has some jams.
Yeah, when you look back on like that, getting interested in Gucci and OJ and that kind of Atlanta scene at that time, mm-hmm. though, like, what was it? How would you articulate now what drew you to that?
So Gucci, I mean, first I paid attention with Icy at the time. Like, Jeezy was the biggest,
right.
rapper. I'm trying to remember what really grabs me, because I still know the thing. It'll be hard for me to say. At first, I just noticed that he was releasing a lot of stuff.
Right.
And this was the time when only Wayne did that.
Right.
Right. But the other thing. Okay, so I mentioned Dylan King, who wrote Government Names. He did this list that was like the 25 best Bun B verses in uh-huh. 2003 or 4, and it ended up, Khalifa Santa ended up linking it in the New York Times.
Really? Wow.
Because it was like the year Bun B just killed, he was doing Free Pimp C run, where he would just kill every guest verse he was on.
Right.
And it became this kind of mythic thing. While it was happening, though, no one was covering it.
Right.
Then at the end of the year, Dylan writes this thing, Khalifa ends up linking to it, and like, what I loved about, so I always like Wayne, and I still like Wayne, but I never liked him as much as a lot of people do.
I never liked him a tenth as much as I like Gucci. I'll say that. Yeah.
And I think, to me, part of that was like the lyric. Like, I like lyrics.
Right. Yeah.
contrary to what my reputation might be after some of the people I've written about, I really like the art of rap lyricism.
Right.
I just think people are define it too narrowly.
Right.
But like, and I remember, like, there's still Gucci verses. Once I heard, it was like you had to tune in, and once you focus the camera lens, you're suddenly like, holy shit, every verse Gucci's dropping is, this is like when Bun did. To me, the Gucci run of like 08 compared closest to Bun's 2004 thing.
Right.
And UGK, his favorite group,
yeah.
as he says in the song. Like, it totally made sense to me. I was like, as soon as that clicked for me, I was like, I need to listen to all of these. And
yeah.
And I started, like, I can still, I know the whole The Time to Eat with Project Pat.
Yeah.
So it was like, the Porsche porcelain, the rims are gorgeous. I can do that whole, like, I know the entire thing. And it was like, when you're 16 and you're like listening to rap and you're rewinding it to like, how does he put these words together?
Right.
You know, I would do that with like Eminem or something, like the Hotter Than a Set of Twin Babies, the Mercedes Benz, whatever.
But Gucci got no respect as a lyricist at that time, even though when you look at that run, you're like, the level of output of shit that he was putting out and the fucking consistency and the fact that every verse was exciting was just unheard of, not to mention his delivery is phenomenal. Because it was so effortless that people looked at it like, oh, this is whatever. Like he got no respect at that time as a lyricist. And I remember Nas pointing out one time in a tweet or something, he said, nobody ever asked Gucci about the music in interviews. They always ask him about who he beat up and who he did this with and partying and blah, blah, blah. But nobody ever asks him about the lyrics. Nobody ever gives him the respect that he deserves for being phenomenal in that regard.
And part of it, too, he does, and I said this in a thing I wrote once, but I think he intentionally courts, like, trash culture. Like, I mean, being in Spring Breakers. Like, just the, like, doing the tape with V-Nasty. He's intentionally, like, don't take me seriously. He says, like, I'm not a real lyricist. He downplays that he's a lyricist in his songs.
Right. You know who we have to blame for that V-Nasty thing? I heard that that was all Zaytoven. Zaytoven told Gucci, do this tape because she's going to be huge. And that's why I did it for free.
Zay's from the Bay.
Exactly. That's what I've been told. And I believe it. It makes perfect sense to me.
I mean, Gucci usually, though, has, like, a great ear for cosigns. That's why that was a little
ridiculous, I mean, over the years, yeah.
She can rap. But,
no, yeah, I love V-Nasty, but it was just a strange project idea that a lot of people didn't really know where it came from.
Yeah, like most of his other cosigns have gotten taken off a little bit higher.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, his trash culture thing, I think him downplaying lyricism is like, I sort of take that as him saying, you can do this too.
Right.
Wayne just complained that rappers don't want to be the greatest anymore.
Right.
The reason that I think, like, there are a lot of rappers who've been influenced by Wayne, but there are a lot of rappers who sound like and have, who I feel like there are more rappers that came up under Gucci.
Right.
And I think that part of that is that he downplays this idea that he's a great lyricist, that he gives you the tools to become an artist yourself. Maybe you're an artist who has some good musical ideas, but you're not that great of a lyricist.
Right.
You listen to Gucci and he tells you, I'm not a great lyricist. And you're like, oh, I can do this too.
Yeah.
I think there's an element of that to it.
Right.
And that he's like a democratizing aesthetic force.
Right.
And then, of course, he's also like the hardest, like he has the street reputation that enables him to be
to have
creative.
A lot of leeway to go in a lot of different directions. Yeah, that's totally true.
And I mean, there's, you know, obviously, there's still an unresolved question that's still worth arguing about, is the degree to which this stuff is like dangerous and has a negative impact on communities and shit like that. But I don't think that people can get to the point of that conversation until they acknowledge aesthetically that what's happening, why it's not, this stuff is not attractive to people just because it's hard.
Right.
There's more to it than that. And until people like give it that serious consideration, it's hard to, how are you ever going to connect with someone who's a fan of Gucci and tell them like, here's why it's bad to sip a lot of lean.
Right.
Which, to be fair, Gucci has said to his fans before is bad.
Yeah.
But until you can understand why it is that people are connecting with him beyond like, it's hard. That there's more. People have to understand that there's more to it than that.
Right.
And I think that's like been probably underneath a lot of my arguments in the past X years about rap music is like, I don't think the aesthetic, I don't believe in art for art's sake. I don't think that the aesthetic is non-political or anything like that. But I do think that the aesthetic matters, that it has a cultural, like it's connected to the real world politics of this.
Right.
Like, you can't just tear them apart and be like, only the politics of this matter.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if I'm making sense.
No, I feel you. But so, in terms of, like, social responsibility, like, do you, when you first started writing about Keith, for example, like, how hard was it for you to separate the fact that, like, on one hand, he's a complete and total representation of, like, where he's from. He's, like, the most extreme version of that type of person who grows up in that type of area. But then also you have all these kids listening to this music, and presumably at least some of them are being motivated to kill people or sell drugs or do whatever. Was that something that was hard, that's hard for you to rationalize when you're writing about somebody, especially like Chief Keef, if you're like helping to elevate him into the mainstream by writing about him for Fader or whatever? What was that like in your head at that time?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the first thing that, like, there is no neutral gear you can shift into, right? I'm a person who covers rap music, and this is a big story happening in the city that I live in. Mm-hmm. And to not do something on it,
and all right, would be lying. Yeah, it would be.
Yeah, at some level, that's a dishonest. Yeah. So, and the other thing too is that it was a different time when that popped off. One of the big things that happened with that, before that, the big like hype things went, hype cycle artists went through this sort of bottleneck in the publications, right? Like A$AP Rocky, I mean, I feel like we know the story of like that going through Yams's blog.
Yeah.
Like that was the point that it blew up from, was Yams Tumblr.
Right.
Like,
and Chief Keef had no jumping off point online, really. There was nobody covering.
Well, what happened was he hit right at the beginning of the social media.
Right.
Like Twitter existed before that, but it wasn't like it is now. There was, I don't think people said the words Black Twitter on like. So what happens is Keef hits right at the moment when we're suddenly starting to get these metrics of like what people are actually listening to.
And right.
I don't think, you know, ASAP and then, you know, Odd Future and that kind of stuff, those are real phenomenons. I'm not trying to like lessen their impact.
But Keef was taking part, it was taking place on a really, really local level. And it was, he was one of the first artists that I remember hearing people say like, yo, he's got 300,000 YouTube views off of this video, and right. it's fucking little kids in Chicago listening to it. Like, it's, the fan base is completely like street level, yeah. which was really exciting at that point to even have that as a metric, because it is so democratic. Like, oh, here's proof that this is influential.
When, and yeah, and I think there was a, there were a lot of people upset at the time that like, people, gatekeepers, were dictating what rap was going to matter next
right.
year.
The
and
blog
it had become
era,
like the
yeah.
fashion world or something, where it right. was like, this year A$AP Rocky is in season. Like, there was no
yeah,
like
yeah, yeah.
Sense of the community actually having.
That was the height of like bloggers having the most influence.
Clout, yeah.
yeah, yeah.
So really, like the right at the time when I like made a name for myself outside of the blogs was right at the moment when we no longer
necessarily
I
needed
feel like
blogs.
I was, I was sort of like the. Suicide bomber of
right
of the rap bloggers, like
right.
I kind of, in writing that story, it kind of took it, it blew up a lot. I think
made you and a lot of your contemporaries,
I mean, it was gonna happen
as essential.
This is like discovering the Mississippi River. It was gonna right. happen yeah, yeah. no matter what, but like it, it definitely was like the moment where the clout that like a rap blogger had was vanishing, because right. now everybody's online on their phone. And that was the other thing, is that the YouTube views were high, not because they were sitting at the computers on YouTube, but because they were watching it on their phones.
Right.
So what this really is the mobile, it's the iPhone revolution
right.
happening to completely shift how people engage with the internet. And suddenly there's all these metrics. It was like the, right. Did you ever see that movie with Brad Pitt about the Oakland A's?
What's it called? Oh,
it's based on
the Inside Baseball one. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The
fuck, I forget the name too. But I did watch that movie. I haven't seen any movies, but I saw that one.
Anyway,
but that's what's
the story
funny.
Of it is like they use these metrics suddenly to measure how good a baseball player is.
Right. Yeah.
And the Oakland A's went from one of the poorest teams in baseball to being in the World Series.
Right.
Then of course the next year, all the major teams started doing the sabermetrics
yes.
stuff, so suddenly the Oakland A's advantage was no longer an advantage.
Right.
Which is basically what happened in the industry. It was like you went from Keef broke through, and then everybody else is suddenly trying to define their success by these same metrics, and it's like you can't. Like, if everybody's doing this, it doesn't.
Right.
It doesn't.
And
happen.
In like 2008, like you knew Nat Wright was influential, but there was no social media metrics that you were basing that on. It was just, well, this feels like that, or I guess like the comments.
There were a lot
like
of
that.
Comments.
Yeah, yeah.
You could, but it was very un. And that was the thing too, is that like a lot of those blogs didn't cover stuff that was hugely popular.
Right, because you know like they're in their own little world. They're not looking at Chicago, the 17-year-old kids in Chicago. They were not looking at that, right?
And that Gucci was huge there. That was part of the reason that I like started covering Gucci in the first place was because you know, I was working this job where I was with a lot of hip-hop fans. I was working at Wrigley Field in Chicago
uh-huh.
and like in the food stands.
Right.
It was one of my less fun jobs, but it was like you know, I was freelancing in my free time, and this was just like a way to pay the bills. And a lot of my coworkers were like, Bricks was a big record,
right?
The Gucci record. And I'm like looking on these hip hop blogs that everybody's reading. This is supposedly what's happening in hip hop, and there's no Gucci songs posted on Not Right until I think Make the Trap.
Dropped. Oh, that was the first. That would be interesting to go back and see what the first Gucci songs were on there.
That was the first one that, like, it might not have been the first one posted on Not Right, but it was the first one that I remember everyone talking about.
Right.
Like, oh, I guess we have to care about Gucci. Like, they were, like, kind of, not excited about talking about.
Nobody in New York, the thoughts on OJ the Juice Man at the time were very mixed.
Yeah. I mean, he also did that, like, really funny freestyle that, like,
The one behind the building with Gucci, or the one with Waka and Nicki?
With Waka and Nicki.
That one was amazing, yeah.
Nicki's Cheese is the classic. But it was also like, I don't know if you've ever seen the interview with Gucci where he talks about how the reason OJ never really took off is like, because he's too rich from street.
But do you believe that, or do you think that's just a nice thing that rappers say about each other to cover their ass?
I believe that.
Really?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I mean,
I don't know.
It almost doesn't, even if it's apocryphal, it kind of doesn't matter. Like, if it's a covering, I don't know. He never struck me as like an artist that had like this insane longevity. Like,
right, yeah.
I think people said that about, it would weird me out when people would see Waka as like, you know, Waka was like on the cover of Spin right before Keith broke out.
Right.
Right. And like, one of those, Waka had a huge moment, but right. It was like a moment. And I don't know that he would have had to evolve in a certain way to really become an artist with huge longevity.
And Waka's mom said in an interview that one of her biggest regrets in her career as a manager was that she fucked up OJ's career in the sense that she didn't have the attention to put into him at that time that she probably would have needed to, which if you think about Gucci or Waka when she was kind of behind their careers, like she did a great job presumably of like making them represent that thing that they were. And I mean, somebody like OJ, it is like a touchy thing. Like, how do you keep the public interested in him? I think that like a manager would be kind of crucial in that.
Yeah, it's really hard to say how much of it is about his own development versus. I don't think like I don't listen to too many of his new records. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have listened to some, and like I don't feel like that they've really moved forward. For
it's him. Hard to wait. Where does he go from there? Yeah,
yeah, and like. You know, it would always be cool when you'd hear like he did a song with Spice One year.
That was an amazing song.
It was really good too.
And they were out in the yard with the huge fucking guns in the mansion and shit.
Like, I feel like there's a way, there's always a lot of these artists who have like a spark but don't necessarily have the like Gucci level longevity.
Right.
There is like, there's almost always like a thing you can do to get people's attention musically. Like, there's a way to frame it, but figuring that out is, I imagine that's very. That's the challenge.
As soon as you started reading about music online, did you also start writing about it online? Like, when did So Many Shrimp come out? And what were you getting paid to write freelance at that time as well? And you were just like, I'm going to put other stuff here? Or was that how you got started in terms of writing?
So Many Shrimp came out, I guess it was my junior or senior year of college. And it came out like in the wake of Gel and Weave and Government Names, which was the two. And then like, you know, and I had started reading Nas's stuff and started reading, Serge and I knew each other from a message board.
Oh, what was the message board at that time?
That was the Sage Francis message board.
Oh, okay.
The nonprofits.
Right.
Which is hilarious.
Was there anywhere else that, like, the conversation about music criticism or, like, people blogging about rap, was there anywhere else that was kind of taking place online? Because I remember at that time I would find out about people through blog roles and everything, but I always kind of had a hard time figuring out, like, who are the music writers that I should be paying attention to if I like these three guys.
I mean, there's, like, a music critic message board that I would read sometimes called ILX that, like, had, but that wasn't really rap-centric.
Okay.
I don't know. Like, I don't think there was like a lot of people obviously were posting at that time. What were the names of the forums back then?
I don't really. Yeah, I never got super into rap forums.
I remember like reading IGN and reading like, which is where they would have Key Style battles.
Right.
Never got into that.
Me neither. Thank God. Yeah.
I almost wish I had, because I think it would be a funny story. But,
that would be amazing, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Hip Hop Infinity, everyone made fun of because, like, it was like the Anticon. I was never, like, a big Anticon guy.
Me neither.
They were really big there.
Sometimes I'll go listen to an instrumental on YouTube, and there'll be people writing like verses to the instrumental in the YouTube comments, which is amazing that that's happening.
I love that. That's great. I hope that that part of the internet never dies, where people like people do stuff that's not tied to their actual name or identity.
Right.
That they like just contribute.
I just like the idea of it because it's like nobody could ever in a million years impress me with the verse that they wrote, without performing that verse. But it's cool to know that there are apparently thousands of people who find this entertaining or interesting. Yeah.
Like they're looking for the complexity of the verbiage. Or
yeah,
something.
Exactly.
But yeah, so I started writing like mainly I just wanted to and I don't think that I knew. I began writing mainly probably because I knew that like the hip hop stuff that was from where I was from, outside of Diverse, who went to my high school, was a very good rapper, had a album with RJD2 at one point. There were not a lot of like successful big rappers coming from where I was.
Right.
Even in Chicago, you know, you had Bump J, Kanye, obviously I was a huge fan of, but like Kanye was like on another level. But the stuff that people were writing about in the blogs, like the local stuff, I knew local artists, I went to shows, but like, I could tell that it wasn't the kind of thing that was about to like take off on or be interesting.
Were they mostly covering like conscious rap and like people who are a lot little of bit more respectable stuff. Type stuff?
It wasn't even necessarily conscious, but it was very like lyrically lyrical in a way that wasn't actually that lyrical in the
And that's
sense.
The scene that was like horrified when Keith came out, right? Like, was that a huge split in Chicago?
Yeah, it's really hard though to like separate the aesthetic objections to him from the like moral ones,
right?
Because
they're both
a lot of the moral ones are
profound,
totally legitimate, and the aesthetic ones are like, of course, like that's gonna happen no matter what,
right?
And so you have this really complex, like the dividing lines over that were so like, it's such a crazy phenomenon. It's so like much bigger than, you know. I mean, he was a teenager, so like I think part of it is just people wanted to blame him because he's this violent thug archetype.
Right.
They want to like blame him for this violence. But at the same time, because he's so young, he's like obviously the product of all of these people that are older than him.
Right.
And their complicity in this system that has led to this. And the crazy thing too, that like, I think that no one really remembered about that.
It's fine. This is an employee.
People thought of him as this like violent super thug kind of thing.
Right.
The reason he blew up in the first place was because the police had shot at him.
Right.
And there was a rumor that he had been killed. And he was this really popular kid who rapped. And when it turned out he hadn't been shot, that he'd just been arrested. Or that they had discharged a weapon at him, he went to jail. That's why his tape was called Back from the Dead.
Right.
This is like before Trayvon Martin happens. This is in and I feel like there must have been at some level this sort of psychic energy of like, people are being, I mean, you know, it's been in rap for years, but just something about that particular story resonating right before like what led to Black Lives Matter happening.
Right.
I feel like it was like this, it's almost like a thermometer gauge or something of what was happening in these communities.
Right.
And that nobody was, and if we had like realized it in covering that at the time, but I mean.
Because he was almost like the consolidation or like the manifestation of so many like feelings that were going on about police brutality and about classism in Chicago and everything.
And
he was so much bigger than just a dude. But you're right, with the young age, I mean, it was so much harder to just say like when people look at Future now and they hate on him for promoting drugs, it's much easier to blame a 32-year-old guy. But when you're talking about a 15-year-old, it's like where do you go with this criticism? Yeah.
And people will be like, well, you know, the parents should, and it's like,
clearly the parents are not terribly involved in this, or like are probably powerless to whatever's going on. So that feels like kind of a bad
attempt. The other thing was that if you could just delegitimize him aesthetically, that was the other thing that people would try to do. Was say that, you know, this is aesthetically bad.
Right.
This is not an artist who should. He's being overhyped because of these surrounding contextual things, mm-hmm. and that the music itself is actually just trash. But I feel like you can see now from like the way that that stuff picked up in the press, and I mean not in the press, in the music scene, in mm-hmm. the way that, like, you know, that picture that was going around Twitter that was like Cardi, Uzi,
right. yeah,
the four guys,
Kodak, like, or something, yeah.
Kodak wasn't in it, but it was.
Oh, right. it was all Cardi, guys, yeah.
And then it looked like three Keefs and a yeah. Fredo. Like,
right.
Everybody has the baby dreads. Everybody does these kind of melodic sing. And obviously, there's influences from, you know, other artists in there. Like,
right.
Young Thug and Migos are both pretty influential.
Do you think Keef was profoundly talented even when he was 15 or 16? Or do you think he yeah. grew into that role because he was in the spotlight?
I think he was extremely talented. Like, I think he's extremely smart kid,
right.
and was insanely talented, and was just in this it's like the way that, you know, liquid fits in the container that it's poured into.
Right.
If you have an insanely brilliant liquid
yeah.
and it's poured into Chicago's south side in amidst poverty and in these projects, like, this is where it goes. And, like, yeah, I mean, it totally changed the sound of rap music.
Right.
And, like, rap music today sounds like that stuff.
Yeah.
Is
Chief Keef still huge in Chicago? Because he's still huge online. He's still, like, puts a video on YouTube. He's getting many, many millions of views. Like, the press of the media still seems excited. The fans on Twitter and Instagram definitely still seem excited. But Keef can't go to Chicago and hasn't been for many years.
He's still big there. I think he's probably bigger in a place like LA now at this point.
Right.
But that's a fairly recent thing. Like, I think he retired from rap.
Right.
I think that since basically this year, maybe last year, was when things started to shift to a new generation. So, uh-huh. like, Famous Dex is the big, like, among, like, the young crowd in Chicago.
Okay.
Famous Dex is by far the biggest new artist.
Okay.
And I think they've probably moved to him. I mean, Keef is still, like, if you ask somebody there, they're like, Keef's a legend. That's, like,
right.
But, like, so Famous Dex, there's a guy on the west side, Ludfo, mm-hmm. as far as, like, the street side of stuff. And then, of course, you know, there's also just this huge scene of, like, Chance the Rapper and Vic and like, there are tons of, like, Chicago really has, and I remember, like, trying to tell people this at the time when Keef was blowing up. It's funny because I became so associated with Keef. At the time, I was like, Kevin Gates is my favorite rapper. King Louis is my favorite Chicago rapper. Look at all this other stuff happening in Chicago.
Right.
But, like, nobody remembers.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's, you know, you get typecast. You get, yeah. you know, people.
Which is fine. Yeah. But it's a big, the scene in Chicago is so big and diverse.
Right.
And, like, goes so far beyond, you know, the bop scene happened. Like, I'm thinking about all the different things that happened in Chicago musically during right. this period, and that don't even, and then not even touching on rap music, like the juke stuff, and like there's just so much, like, and I think, yeah, but Famous Dex, Ludfo, those are recent guys that I feel like are, there's some other, I mean, obviously G Herbo and was part of the original wave, but
right.
he had a huge hit last summer with I'm Rollin'.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff, like, locally that's still happening that feels separate from what happens on the coasts.
Do you think that the average kid in Chicago is able to appreciate Chief Keef and fucking Chance at the same time, and that they don't view that as being contradictory, or do you think that they are distinct scenes?
They're definitely distinct scenes, but I think that most kids probably appreciate both of them on some level, with some gravitating more towards one than the other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Chance is like on the verge of becoming like a
yeah.
massive star.
Right.
Like, he's about to be one of the biggest stars in hip hop.
Right.
Potentially.
It does seem.
I'm really curious what he's going to do on his next.
What was how did you feel when you listened to Chance's verse on the first song on the Kanye album? Because that was a pretty monumental. I mean, everybody I know talked about the way they felt when they heard that.
Even when I don't like this, I mean, I like that song a lot. But even when I don't like the songs that, like, Chance did, I don't want to make fun of someone else, but Chance has done lots of guest verses. Every time he does, he just completely kills it.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
The guy is, like, one of the best rappers. Like, even if I can totally get why, like, aesthetically, some people don't like certain. He does the kind of the child voice and the there's right. a lot of like this sort of
that held me back from enjoying them at first. Yeah, to be honest.
Well,
but then
10 Day didn't really work, like, and I mean part of it I think is just like 10 Day came out right when Chicago's in the middle of this whole like controversy about violence and stuff, and it like basically feels like isolated from it, which isn't his like that's it was totally a legitimate expression of his experience, but it totally didn't jive with the times, right?
Right.
But like, I think once his sound has matured in the on acid rap, and it just became like, there's just too much talent there for you to deny.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that he had like he's had a huge aesthetic impact.
Right.
Like all the artists that don't go in the direction of Keith, I feel like went in the direction of Chance. Like,
right.
You still find guys singing and over doing that kind of sing song with the, I don't know how to describe it. I'm a writer, not a
but yo, but that's kind of interesting because when Kanye says on the skit on the album, he says, you know, I look around and there's so many Kanyes. Do you, like, you've been around long enough to see the impact that Kanye had on somebody like Chance, but Keith is kind of not post Kanye in the sense that he probably never gave a shit about Kanye.
I bet he liked like the hits.
Yeah, casually heard everything, but
aesthetically, like he's clearly a Gucci.
Right,
like, Gucci was his. I did an interview with him for Complex when I first started working there that was like, you know, you're the 25 songs that influenced you or something like that. And he named one of his songs, one of his own songs, and like 24 Gucci songs.
Really?
Something like that, yeah.
I can't believe you even were able to get Keith to like sit down and do that.
Or maybe it was all of his own songs. And then the last one was Gucci Mane's entire catalog. Something like that. It was some like insane.
Yeah.
I asked him what his favorite Gucci song was. It was Spanish Plug.
Okay.
His favorite tape was, and Andrew Nas made fun of me for this, but it was Andrew Nas's favorite Gucci tape, which is the Gucci Sosa.
Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah.
So Gucci Sosa is his favorite Gucci tape.
But the one he's on? Oh, no, that's Back in the Dead too. Or yeah. what was the one that they did together? Fucking,
I forget what it's called.
Yeah.
Off the top of my head.
It's so hard to fucking... I feel guilty
Gucci
about that.
Gucci Sosa was like the... From 2008 or something.
Right, yeah. Damn, that's fucking crazy.
It's like a Zaytoven. It's an all Zaytoven tape.
Right. Yo, let's talk about... let's talk about just writing in general and like the business of being a writer and everything too, because we just cover Chicago hard. I want to...
As expected.
Yeah, like... So working as a freelance writer in 2016... Is it, how's it going for you, and how would you advise people that want to make a living as a writer?
It's going, it's hard to do.
Mm-hmm.
And partly because of the way that, like, my career is shaped in large part by my own stubbornness.
Okay.
And also in my lack of connections. Like, all connections I made were done, like, through public internet. Like, literally finding people online and emailing them and them reading my blog and that kind of thing.
Right.
And I felt very much like an outsider when I came up, in part because I didn't like what the press covered. I didn't like how they wrote about it. It didn't really resonate with me and it didn't feel true to what was actually happening. It felt sort of distanced.
So when you say stubbornness, you mean like you didn't really want to go write about the shit that people wanted you to write about necessarily because you had your own opinions?
Yeah. And not just my own opinions, but my own
taste.
Idea of what, and beyond taste, like what was happening in the world felt distant from the five artists that all the people in the press were required to talk about.
Right.
So like at a certain point, I was in New York for 3 years. I worked at Complex for two of those full time and then just freelance for everybody for a year. And at a certain point I was like, I think I had done it. It was doing an interview with T.I. And I was like, you know, interview number 4 of 8 people that he talked to sitting in an office in Manhattan. And I'm like, what is the point of doing this? Like, you become a celebrity news reporter at a certain level of success. You're expected basically to gain a little bit of real estate on the internet for the publication you work for, reporting on what celebrities are doing.
Right.
So getting to, if you're really successful, if you get T.I. to say something stupid, or if your editor just is a really good headline writer.
Right.
And then, like, you're in competition with the 7 other interviews that all go up within 24 hours of each other.
Right.
And if yours is last, if yours is the, you can have done the best interview.
And if you're last,
if the headline
you're fucked,
sucks, or if you're last, nobody will, it's like a, heavy stone dropped in like the bottom of a well.
Was because Complex, you know, I fucks with them hard, but they do have a reputation for being a little bit tabloidy at this point and stuff. Did you feel like there was like a weird corporate culture there, or like in the newsroom, or was it just like any other place?
I think that Complex actually ended up anticipating how a lot of places are now. Mm-hmm. Like I see New York Times Facebook posts that remind me of Complex.
Yeah.
I mean,
which reminds you of like Upworthy posts or like all the like blatant viral, you know, pick out ones. Yeah.
I mean, it's just like the world has changed to being what Complex was in 20 when I was there. Like,
right.
And actually, Complex was it was one of the more diverse publications, and it had. I like Complex. I like the people that worked there, and obviously, like I had. As someone who had been mostly freelancing, I had trouble in some ways adapting to the way things worked. But also we were at the time like really sort of trying to do something new that wasn't really being done. We were trying to like cover stuff in response to a news cycle that had become suddenly very, very fast.
Right.
Like, even so, like when Keith comes out, I'm saying like that happened like with the dawn of the social media era.
Yeah.
This was right at the beginning of that.
Right.
I started working for them in October 2012, mm-hmm. and like all of a sudden how a publication's success is measured changes drastically.
Right.
And the people are more interested. Facebook really takes over at this point, where people are more interested in individual articles than the masthead.
Right.
That a Complex article is as successful as its headline, not necessarily as the Complex.
Right, because you can't really expect almost anybody who's a Complex fan to actually be going to the Complex website every day. Whereas during the blogger era, you were a Now Right fan. That's because you went on your computer and typed in NowRight.com every day. And that going away was really like the big thing that changed for the blogs in terms of the fact that everybody's going on Twitter. If you want to be a blogger, you probably got to, most of your traffic is going to be coming from you pushing that shit out on Twitter and Facebook.
And it turns people into personalities, that you have to be a personality and a brand to succeed as a writer.
Right.
That's not true. Let me rewind that. I hope nobody thinks that that's true, but that is a way that people, it's like the Donald Trumping of the game. Like, if you make the biggest, it doesn't matter how well honed your personal brand is, how quality your work is.
Right.
If you come out there and make the biggest gesture, if you're like, if you can be seen by the cheap seats, that matters way more in terms of your exposure and your ability to garner an audience.
And like with Donald Trump, the strength of him, like I was talking to somebody who went to one of his rallies recently, and they were like, you realize the whole reason that he's successful is because he's so one-sided in talking about this fucking wall. And he just keeps saying, we're going to build a wall, they're going to pay for it, we're going to bring a wall. And that like stupidity, the total ridiculousness of that, but that's what makes him resonate, is because he has this basic message that is just so easy for people to latch onto.
That and racism.
And like, all that, that probably appeals to a lot of people too,
But it's the simplicity of the message that can be seen. And I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with simple. Like, that's the whole, like, art of wrestling, right, is based around this idea that, like,
all caricatures.
You can't, like, make a small gesture in wrestling. Everything has to be visible to everyone.
Right.
Everyone has to understand what your gesture means.
Right.
If you're grinning, you have to really grin. If you have the eyebrow is like it has to be something that has a clear meaning to everybody in the room.
You're a big strong guy. You're a big 300-pound guy. You can't be the little 150-pound strong guy. You know, everything has to be larger than life. That's
and,
what people
and
want.
And figuring out how to do that on social media is like leads to a lot of the people with the biggest names. I think if you're talking like, and I'm not talking about writing even necessarily, but like. But yeah, sure. Anthony Fantano,
right,
is a he's the example of the like, he represents, I think, the authoritative white dude in
music
his
nerd
most
guy.
Like honed, compact.
It's hard to imagine somebody doing a better job of what he does than like what he does, in the sense that he puts out so much shit. It's so consistently, you know,
him.
Exactly what you expect. He,
right.
he latched onto the vlogger thing on YouTube before anybody else, which is
he embodied our idea of what a music critic is so completely.
People
are like, but what does the music critic think about it? And immediately you think of Fantana.
Right.
He's the Donald Trump of, and you know, slightly less racist.
I think he seems like a nice guy, and sure. I respect what he's built like crazy. It doesn't appeal to me that much, but yeah, but the thing is that it's very motivational to me to think like, fuck, it's so cool to see somebody who's obsessed with music take it into their own hands and build this thing that he's presumably making a shitload of money off. But then at the same time, you're like, well, that is so not a role that the average music writer. Like, I could not imagine you sitting in front of the camera like that. I couldn't imagine Nas doing that. It doesn't line up very well with the personality of a music writer.
Well, so the main thing is I like the craft of writing.
Right.
I enjoy reading good analytic writing about music that thinks about how music works and how it functions for the listener. And that is something that like does not have a. It's a lot harder to brand that as a thing.
Right.
So if I was like a young music writer right now, my first advice would be that things change so fast that you cannot follow a pre-existing path. Mm-hmm. You basically have to figure out what you like doing 8+ hours, like what you don't mind.
Right.
If you can sit at a computer and type and write for many hours a day, then you should keep doing it. Like, but you have to figure out. You can't plan too far in advance.
Right.
My whole thing was like I was stubborn about not really getting. You know, I didn't have connections in publications at all. I was like, I think eventually I finally got in at Vibe because during like one of the festival weekends in Chicago, I recognized John Carmonica from a photo that he'd posted online.
Okay.
And I like walked up to him at the Empty Bottle in Chicago and was like, "Hey, you write," and I like in like. I interviewed Gorilla Zoe on the Scream tour because as someone who did it that way, I think that that's a preferable way. I feel like I have more freedom to make decisions about what I want to cover and that I do it for the reason that I got into it in the first place.
Uh-huh.
I can still write about, I just did an interview with this rapper from Chicago, Cupcake.
Yeah. I just saw that. I haven't had a chance to listen to her even though I read it though.
She's wild.
Right.
And, but really talented and like, that's the kind of thing that I feel like if I was a staff writer at a place, I would have to fight uphill to like, no, seriously, guys. Like, whereas as a freelancer, there is something liberating, even if you can't like match the Fantanos of the world in scale.
Yeah.
Which honestly should not be your goal. Your goal should be to enjoy what you're doing and still pay your rent.
Right.
And like, to me, the way that I got to that point was basically by figuring out what I liked doing.
Right.
Really honing in on what I enjoyed about the process of this.
But so, and what is that? The writing? The putting words together?
I think it's more trying to understand. So I love music and trying to find music that I love.
Right.
And then how do I express my love of that? So like music that I really love, if I like a song and it's like the best song I've ever heard for the moment, it gives me an energy that I want to. You know, I'm from Chicago. There's a lot of house music there. I like to dance. I'm a big, big dancer.
Really? I wouldn't have saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. People don't believe, but it's true.
Okay.
Me and my friends in like, after high school, but friends from high school would go out like to nightclubs and stuff just for that sort of thing.
Wow.
Smaller spaces, not like bottle service.
Hey, we're going dancing when I come to Chicago. That sounds great.
That's perfect.
Wow. All right, cool.
Hit up Smart Bar. The thing that, like, I feel like dancing is like a. Writing is basically, to me, it's dancing. It's like you trying to create something, except I'm doing writing with the idea that more than, like, a small group of people will see me.
And when you're dancing, you probably are kind of hoping that not that many people see you.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the opposite of writing in that way, yeah.
If I can impress a girl, that'd be cool. But, like, with the writing, it's more like. I want to create something that channels that energy that the music gives me into something that people will actually enjoy reading.
Right.
And in some ways, I think the internet, even though I will complain about certain aspects of like how social media has warped music writing and kind of devalued writing, it also has forced, I think, a discipline in writing that like I'm afraid every time I write something that I'm going to lose people by sentence number two.
Right.
And like, it's really forced me to be like, all right, what am I actually trying to get across here and get right to the point? And I think that's actually like that kind of economy is totally a positive. It has a positive effect on people's writing if they realize that they're
what they're doing. Right. And because like, you're not writing the headlines, but the first couple sentences, you in a sense are kind of writing the headlines in the sense that you're trying to keep people roped in and keep them interested in what you're saying.
Right.
So in that sense, anybody who writes anything is sort of working with you know, they're applying or appealing to the metrics or the analytics that, you know, a headline writer is doing.
And metrics and analytics really are, like, they're ridiculous. But, everybody wants to write for people.
Right.
You do it to be read.
Everybody wants to make 1,000 people happy rather than 10 people. So, you know, the headline writing, it does, it appeals to what the writer wants as well in a weird way. So it's...
And there have been times, I will complain about, you know, the headline-driven thing, but I do it. Like, I did the Mozzie article I did at the end of last year was, like, the best rapper of 2015 that no one listened to.
So you wrote that headline? Like
that. Yeah.
Because I did notice that headline. I was like, oh, that's a good headline from Mozzie. That's going to get a lot of people looking at him.
It's true, you know, and I think the thing that worked also is that it was true. That, like, unless you were from the, like, Bay Area satellite and tuned into, like, underground rap, because I knew people who were from the Bay that had no idea who he was, but they just sort of know rap, they know, love Mac Dre and Jack or whatever, but they're not, like, keeping up daily with what's happening with, like, Filthy Rich's latest, you know?
Right, yeah.
So, like, I thought it was that one works because it doesn't lie to people.
It's not clickbait. It's like, actually, that's your real opinion, yeah.
And it also, I think it's like it's a huge gesture, right?
Right.
It's like, sort of grabs you by the throat.
But like you're saying with the wrestling, you know, you need that big gesture. It's like Mozzie has to be the best rapper from the Bay that you haven't heard from this year, rather than like, yo, here's a cool rapper. Yeah.
So at a certain point, like complaining about like how the metrics work ends up feeling like you're trying to work the refs or something. Like,
right, yeah, yeah.
You know, either don't hit the player, hit the game.
Right. You are a real wrestling fan, or you just happen to know enough to make
friends
analogies?
Of mine. Okay. One of my best friends is like a huge wrestling
We've
fan.
We've all got that friend.
I pick up stuff through him, yeah.
Yeah, and
he had the Cactus Jack shirt in like high school.
Okay.
And like, yeah.
Before every like hipster kid's wearing a vintage wrestling shirt
these
days.
Oh yeah, this was like 1999.
Right.
This was like a new shirt, I'm pretty sure.
At a certain point from watching my friend's obsession with wrestling, and I realized like, oh, this is, you guys like this shit for the exact same reason that I like rap music.
Yeah.
These big caricatures of masculinity and their... You know, you like to see how they hone their craft, and or I even think that with like comic books. I'm like, my friends who are perfectly happy reading like, you know, 10 new Batman graphic novels every year or whatever is kind of like me listening to like 10 Gucci Mane mixtapes in 2014 or whatever.
Yeah, I like, I think what I like in rap is what I like in art in general, but like that idea, this is getting very pretentious, but there's a Bart essay about wrestling, Roland Bart, and it's like, he talks about how the wrestler embodies the full length of the gesture. That it's not like seeing how far you can go. It's like seeing how well you can fill in the shape, like the color fills in the whole shape.
Or
the,
right.
And I think that art that really like when it makes a gesture, you don't want like a half step.
Right.
You want the thing to represent the thing.
Right.
Otherwise, it feels kind of scared to me. And that, like, affects my taste, I think, and to some degree that, like, some of the more alt-rap kind of guys, I started to feel like I was being insecure.
Uh-huh.
My enjoyment of it was, like, I couldn't handle the full gesture.
Right.
I was, like, doing this kind of half step. Ain't no half stepping.
Yeah.
It's hip-hop.
There's not no half stepping. Right. Half stepping is
not
useless.
No, not so. No half stepping.
Fuck. All right, so we only got a little bit of time left.
Yeah, I don't know if I've answered all your questions very well.
I think it's been great.
Like,
yeah, yeah.
Six footnotes.
No, I'm very excited about this. I know, because that's one thing you notice with writers is that a lot of times they almost seem like they specifically are the types of people who take a while to answer the questions, because when you are writing, you have so much time to analyze every single word in the sentence and you know, figure out how you want to put it all together. But then you're doing like a podcast and it's on the spot. You got to figure out how to express yourself. It's such a different way of communicating.
When I used to do the podcast with Andrew Barber and Ernest Wilkins.
And what was it called?
It was called Disrespectful Radio.
I think that was the first rap podcast I ever listened to.
That's dope.
Yeah.
If we had kept that up, which is totally my fault, not theirs, I moved to New York.
Right.
I feel like it would be a big...
You had Katie on there, right?
Oh, yeah. We had Katie. We had DJ Ken. We had D-Gaines.
Okay. And Katie accidentally mentioned that she had a job, which I remember was like a thing that she was like, yeah, because I was at work. Oh, wait. I ain't supposed to say that. And I thought that was so awesome seeing behind that for a second. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the thing that I love about Chicago rap in general, is it's still completely connected to the community. Like,
right.
It's rap and it's like organic, like community based
right.
thing. And obviously people want to get rich, but it's such this like vague idea.
It's just pie in the sky. Because don't you think a lot of people who are rapping, it's, yeah, they'd like to get rich, whatever, but it's more about getting respect in their neighborhood from their friends, from their contemporaries.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah. and like, so the interview with Cupcake that I just did, her big breakout record is this ridiculous, like, you know, Slackness, like in Jamaican, in dancehall slack is like, yeah. it's like extreme sexual.
Right.
So that's what her big breakthrough was, this song called Vagina, and then she did the song called Deep Throat, and then she did the song called Juicy Coochie.
Okay.
And these are all like, and like I talked to her, like those are the only three like freaky songs she has. The other ones are, she's a really well-rounded artist, but those are the things that broke through for her.
Right.
And it's funny because, so I asked her like, you know, how did you come up with this? Like, what was your writing process like for those songs? Like, she was like, you know, people think that I did this to get famous, but honestly, I was just like honestly feeling it in that moment. Like, I was just like, I was in a very sexual place, and I wrote, I'm totally paraphrasing her, obviously, and I just wrote that shit on paper, and it felt true to me. And I think, like, that's what it's about. Like,
yeah.
And I think people can see through when you're trying to make something that will make you popular.
Right.
And you're not doing it for, and that works for, like, writing, and that works for any kind of art. Like, criticism is an art like any other.
Right.
It can be derivative, it can be bad, but it can also be really good.
That's why I hate when I see people who are saying, like, oh, you know, fuck haters. Don't never pay attention to a critic, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, no, you should definitely pay attention to a critic. They're getting paid to do this. This is a whole thing for them. Even if, like, you could definitely learn something from it, even if you completely disagree with what they're saying.
Sometimes that's the best. I call, oh, I had a word for it, and I've forgotten what it is. But it's, there are certain people that you know when they're completely disagreeing with you that you're doing everything right.
Yeah, oh, exactly.
And,
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
I love, those people can be more, those people are more important to me than my friends sometimes when it comes to, like, what do I actually think about this?
Yeah.
And when I see how, like, somebody that I'm like, that person is not who I want to be. Like,
yeah.
And sometimes people will surprise you, but for the most part, there are people I know, I'm like, that guy likes that. I can't.
Yeah.
I knew something was fucked. Something was up with it already.
I would love to list off all the people that fill that space in my life right now. Yeah. All right. Is there anything we should wrap this up with? Where can people go to keep up with your work online?
I'm Twitter at So Many Shrimp. I haven't really been keeping an archive of my writing, which I need to get around to doing, because I really did a lot in the last couple of years. Like, when I was at Complex, especially, I was churning them out there for a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah, just follow me on Twitter and I'll
scroll post back. Eventually. Yeah, scroll so back Shrimp, a few months, you'll find all kinds of stuff.
I appreciate you all taking the time to listen to all the way through this. So my advice for a young writer, though, would be to find something that you care about. There was a great article in The All that was about this. It was like advice for young journalists, and it was like, find something that you love and want to write about and care about. Like, you want to know everything about this subject.
Right.
And to the point, it's something that is as far from people making money from it as one can imagine.
Right.
But the only other people that talk about this shit with you are people who are like societally unable to hold down jobs.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, that everybody around you are people that do it because they love it too.
Right.
Not because there's any money in it whatsoever. Because once, eventually, something happens and that blows up, and then you end up being the person that's there. And even if you're not technically qualified for like the kind of work you should be.
Right.
Like, you haven't gone to the internships, you haven't done the, you're coming at it from the outside, but you're the one that knew about, yeah, like, you did the work here.
Right.
And like, as long as you really do the work because you love doing that work, you'll become, lodged in the system.
Right.
Eventually. And like, unless, of course, it could also just fail.
Also, never, you write about, you know, bluegrass for your whole life, and you never, nobody ever gives a shit. But right. But there's probably, you know, if you have 1,000 bluegrass fans out there, well, that are excited about your blog or whatever.
What if Yes Jules suddenly becomes like,
right,
loves bluegrass, and suddenly there you're like, you're in her Music Monday joint, and then like, you know,
you're predicting a vast societal change right there that I'm very excited for, the Yes Jules bluegrass country and blues album or whatever. Yeah, that'd be amazing.
That's a good note to end.
It's a strange way that we just ended this, yeah. And I keep talking about her too much on here. It's like kind of, it's almost getting creepy. We were talking about it with 40 Ounce Van the other day too. But yo, David, thank you so much for coming in. This is a really awesome conversation.
Thanks.
I'm very glad
we
got to do this.
Absolutely.
And everybody out there, check out So Many Shrimp, the website as well as the Twitter. You still update the website?
Occasionally, rarely. Right. I should also shout out Serge.
Okay.
Who, me and Serge founded that website. I don't want to like take him off the. Yeah, Beer and Rap.
Beer and Rap.
He did.
Oh, that was his originally.
That was Beer and Rap is his.
Well. Okay.
And So Many Shrimp was me and him.
Right.
And over time, we had Byron Crawford wrote for us for a little while.
Okay.
Then a bunch of other people did. My friend Tyrone, who's recently did the Gawker piece on Kevin Gates and Eating Booty.
Right.
That was his big.
Crucial stuff. Yo, Byron Crawford, does he ever go to LA? Probably not, right?
Byron? No, probably not.
No.
But you should definitely get him on the show if you
can. FaceTime or something. That'd be interesting.
I mean, you know, he's a controversial guy.
He is. And he's been blogging his ass off for all these years. And it'd be very interesting to get his perspective.
Yeah. He's definitely somebody that I think, whatever you think of him, he'll tell you what he thinks of you.
I need that. All right, David, thank you very much. No Jumper, subscribe to us on YouTube, SoundCloud, and iTunes. Peace.
Hi, man. What's up? Thank you, man. Appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Hey, it was fun. I just got to take a picture against that wall.